Freedom Radio and Rush 89 FM Hamilton. Very nice day. It's nice and cloudy in Auckland today, and it's remarkably moist and elsewhere in the country after massive floods have washed out ridiculous amounts of bridges and delaying and basically washing away whole campsites. There was this guy standing on a observation platform that's like 10 metres above the river, and the river was lapping at his feet. A lot of rain, man. Straight out of nowhere. Same thing's happening in Australia too, apparently. In fact, both New Zealand and Australia have given police emergency powers to evacuate whole towns that have been cut off by the floodwaters. It's freaking biblical out there. Oh, the disaster. But, you know, terrible disasters happen all the time. Can't be linked to anything. It's all just a coincidence. No, I mean that seriously. Sorry if it sounded sarcastic. Yeah. I did think that we've got this great guest coming on next, hopefully, who's a climatologist, historical climatologist. Now, you know, we've all heard that there's this such a thing as a medieval warm period, and it kind of debunks global warming a little bit. But of course, the global warming lovers, you can call them that without getting sued or something, with their ridiculously overpriced lawyers that Al Gore can pay for with his billions of dollars that he's making on carbon taxes that are already being traded. No, seriously, there's carbon taxes already being traded. We've got what was it, my friend Vappy Cooping, she bought shares in one of these carbon trading companies, and every year she gets a little prospectus about what's happening in carbon trading that year, just so she could do that. It's quite amusing, really, because they're trading something that actually hasn't yet come in. It's almost like the financial speculators are expecting it to come in regardless, come hell or high water. And I watched a documentary earlier today called Who Really Owns New Zealand, or something along those lines, where legislation was passed, carte blanche, massively reshaping the entire country. When that kind of stuff happened in, say, Argentina and stuff like that, there was, like, you know, riots and, like, people screwing whole cities up. Here in New Zealand, virtually nothing. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the sunny slave capital, Auckland, at the vinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Well, there's only one thing I need to know. Whose side are you on? I got some so-called friends. My right to my face, all when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Whose side are you on? I'm flying a JFK.
My heart goes Welcome boom, back, boom. Ladies and gentlemen. I know that customs man. Yeah, man. I don't really like them customs men, especially if they work for the TSA. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I have a very special guest for you, ladies and gentlemen. His name is Dr. Tim Ball. Now, speaking of climatology, the Church of Climatology, of course, there are certain people who really want to make a whole lot of money out of the climate change movement and back faulty science in order to push their agenda through. And we'd like to have a lot of perspectives of different people on this show, especially well-qualified historical climatologists like Dr. Tim Ball. Welcome to the program, sir.
Well, thank you, Vinnie. Thanks for the opportunity.
Hey, it's always a good idea. If something's always given to you, you've got to give something back to the community. And I believe that those who stand up for you, you should stand up for them. Now, I'd love you to divulge a little bit for myself and for the listeners, of course, just a little bit about yourself and what your views are on climate change.
Sure. I guess I could start out by saying that I've been studying climate so long that when I started out, global cooling was the threat. And of course, we've gone through full cycle through the warming thing. But I was in the Canadian Air Force and flying, tracking Russian submarines in the North Atlantic for 4 years. And then I was 5 years search and rescue in the Arctic of Canada. But I lost my flying category, and I didn't want to fly a desk. So I took a small cash settlement and went back to university and thought, well, climate, that's a very interesting area to do some research in. Nothing political about that, and what a surprise. But I ended up getting a PhD in climatology at the University of London, England, Queen Mary College. And then after that, I taught at the University of Winnipeg for 25 years. And I've served on various governments, committees and boards of inquiry into climate. And I was chair of a Canadian committee on climate fluctuations. And I published a great deal, still continue to publish, not as much as I did when I was full-time in the university, and do a lot of public speaking. And the most recent effort is the involvement with this book, The Slaying Sky Dragon, which is an attempt to explain to the public what's wrong with the whole climate science issue. So that's a general background on me. And of course, I publish articles frequently, two a week on Canada Free Press.
So, you know, it's good to have somebody who actually knows what they're talking about, or really would be looked up to as an authority, because often when people say, like the layman, will go up to people like Greenpeace supporters, for example, will be heralded as, I don't know, right-wingers or some description of ad hominem argument, rather than debating the issues and then claiming that we have no credibility. And in your opinion, what is in fact happening with the climate today? I mean, is it warming? Is it cooling? Is it what's happening here?
Well, what's happening right now is that there's been a very slight cooling trend since about 2000. You can make the trend bigger if you want to go to 1998 as your starting point, because 1998 was a warm year due to the El Nino. But if you take from 2000 to the present, there's a slight cooling trend. Of course, you hear them saying, oh, well, the 2010, the warmest year on record. What's amusing about that, of course, is they said it at the end of October, before the year was even over. And I guess only governments can get away with that kind of thing. But and, of course, what you need to know is the extent to which they have manipulated the global climate data. I mean, for example, in Canada, they used to have 600 stations that they used to determine the temperature of Canada. That's down to 7. And what they've done is eliminate or kept in only those stations that, because of things like the urban heat island effect, show a warming, and then they don't adjust for it. And so there's been manipulation of the data. But in fact, as everybody knows from the records that are coming from around the world, the record colds, the Southern Hemisphere have been setting record colds for about 4 years now. And so they've got themselves into this situation where they're having to say that the warming, or the cooling, I should say, is due to warming. And of course, that's so illogical that even people that don't understand the science are saying, well, hang on a minute here. But just to put the thing in perspective, Vinny, when you it depends. Like you notice, I mentioned cooling since 2000, and even more dramatic cooling from 1998. You can determine the trend line that you want to do by the length of record that you choose to use. I mean, for example, if we go back 20,000 years, when the world's in the middle of an ice age, you can say, well, in the last 18,000 years, the world's generally warmed up. But there have been dramatically cooler periods in that period of time. So it depends on where you pick your starting point and your ending point as to what trend you want to argue for. And, of course, that's part of the game that's played. Generally, what you can say is that the climate fluctuates and changes all the time. And, of course, that's one of the great myths that they've played on is the public generally don't know the extent to which climate changes naturally, and it fluctuates a great deal all of the time, and only when you understand that do you understand that what's going on right now is well within normal variability and normal patterns.
Now, Tim, can you lay out why government institutions may have an incentive to manipulate such climate data?
Well, of course, that's the interesting question, that now Mother Nature's not playing along with their game, and it's being exposed, and people are starting to ask questions. The big question that's coming up, and I've been addressing this for the last two or three years publicly, I was doing it more in my research before that, but the question becomes, what's the motive to deceive the public over climate? And of course, there are certain key people. I think that one of the things that the public need to understand is that old adage that no one person can change the world or influence the world is simply not true. The problem is that invariably the influence is for the negative, such as Hitler, for example. Back in the 1960s, there was a thing called the Club of Rome that was set up. Several world leaders involved with it, Mikhail Gorbachev as a member, and John Holdren, the current science czar for Obama, was involved with it. And what they were arguing was basically a Malthusian argument. Now, Malthus was the Englishman who said that the population will outgrow the food supply. And so the whole thing evolved around a growing population making too many demands. Malthus was, of course, on food, but the Club of Rome was looking at it as too many demands on total resources. And, of course, what they said was not only are there too many people, but as they industrialize and their economies improve, the demand per person increases to an unsustainable level. So they came out with a book called The Limits to Growth, which was part of this idea. Now, one of the people involved with that was a guy by the name of Morris Strong. And Strong, a Canadian who came from a very strong socialist background in southern Manitoba and moved to the States when he was 15, made a whole pile of money as an industrialist. And, of course, that's the hypocrisy of these people is that they make the money and then tell other people they can't make money. But Strong decided through his connections with the Club of Rome that he actually made the statement to a researcher by the name of Elaine Dewar in a book called The Cloak of Green that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? And, of course, that's an interesting thing to think about. I mean, you know, people can make statements, but to actually bring them about, and particularly that particular statement, how would you do that? Dewar said to him in the interview, well, if you have that idea, why don't you run for politics and make the changes? And he said, oh, no, you can't do anything as a politician. It's probably the only honest statement he ever made in his life. But he said, I'm going to go to the UN where I can get all the money I want, not be accountable to anybody. And he went to the UN and set up the United Nations Environment Program, and in that he set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the focus, of course, and this is the one question that everybody should ask themselves, is how come CO2, which is such a minuscule part of the total weather system, how did it become the focus and the cause of everything? I mean, it's analogous to say...
How much does CO2, yeah, make up again? Sorry, Tim. How much does...
Well, CO2 is less than 4% of the total greenhouse gases. And water vapor is 95%, but they never talk about that because, of course, they can't handle it in their computer models and the clouds that are created from it. But CO2 is less than 4%.
Oh, sorry? Come on. Well, don't say that they can't tax clouds. They could tax them if they want to.
Of course, that's the one thing the governments do efficiently is tax anything. They're very good at that. You wish they were as good at running all other forms of government as they are at finding ways to tax you.
Someone said to me the other day, why don't the government just have a blanket tax, one solid tax, instead of, you know, tax upon your house, tax upon, I don't know, 30 different aspects of your life? Why don't they have one solid tax? And I said to them, because then they'd have to have 60% income tax, and it'd be plainly obvious to everyone that they're slaves.
Well, and of course, what you would do then is, and it's through the bureaucracies, by the way, that's the greatest threat. The enemy is within. And so you'd have to reduce the bureaucracy tremendously. If you look at what Gordon Brown did in Britain while he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Treasury Minister, and then as Prime Minister, he increased the bureaucracy by over 3 million people. And you look at the growth of the bureaucracy under Obama, those people are going to vote for you. And not only that, but your families are going to vote for you as well. So it's the growth of the bureaucracies, and it's within the bureaucracies. And by the way, that's what Strong did. Now, just to get back to my point about the CO2, he wrote the rules for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to focus on CO2. Now, why CO2? Well, how would you shut down an industrialized nation? How would you go about doing that? And if you think about the industrialized nation like a car, and it's a very good analogy because they're basically both running on fossil fuels, you can squeeze the fuel line, shut off the fuel supply, and the car will stop running. But if you did that in a nation, people would scream immediately, and you see that whenever the price of gasoline goes up quickly, as it's going to do this coming through this winter. But you can also stop the car by plugging the exhaust. So if you could show that the CO2 that's coming out of these industrialized nations is causing global warming and is going to destroy the planet, then you can make it the focus of your concerns. And so that's why CO2 has become such a big issue. I mean, they talk about carbon footprint. It's not carbon, it's CO2. It's another of the false wording that they use. And
So many great points, Tim. And I'm glad you touched on Maurice Strong, because he's someone who's gone over my radar recently. The guy's a wicked man. But, yep. I mean, your point there, you touched on socialism too, how they use basically a socialist model on the ground, growing government, making everyone employees, well, that's the final goal, and so that they consolidate their power from, you know, empowering these people. But then if you shut down the car, if you shut down the engines of industry, shouldn't the Socialist Workers United parties be worried about that?
Well, of course, that was one of the ironies, is that when they first were bringing out the cap and trade and the impact it was going to have on the automobile industries, the auto unions were totally opposed to it. And of course...
They support the climate change agenda.
Yeah, and so you know, this is the dilemma that they had. But of course, the thing is that people like Maurice Strong doesn't care about people or groups. It's just whoever he can use to achieve his agenda. So
they're the elites. They're meant to be hypocrites.
Yeah. And of course, by the way, Maurice Strong is now hiding out in China. And I use that term deliberately because the U.S. Department of Commerce are after him and his son, and Kofi Annan and his son, because they made millions off of the oil for food in Iraq situation. So these people are exploiters.
Is this the oil for food that killed about 250,000 Iraqi children?
Yep, that's the one.
Oh, yeah, and, okay. All right, he's a philanthropist then, I see.
Well, charity support him. Isn't it loving and liberal?
Oh, yes. Yeah, but anyway, so what Strong did then was he set up this the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And by the way, the people that were in control of that, people like Phil Jones, Tom Wigley, Stephen Schneider, these are all names that you know because they were all connected with the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia where the emails were leaked. And one of the things that I've learned, Vinny, over the years is I've served on many commissions of inquiry, and the politicians love them because it makes them look like they're moving it to arm's length from a political interference. So, oh, great, there's going to be a commission of inquiry. The very first one I was appointed to was to deal with conflict over water in a particular lake, and I thought, oh, yeah, this is nice. The government are going to stay out of this. We'll be able to get to the bottom of the problem and come up with some reasonable solutions. The minute that we got the terms of reference, I realized how the politicians retain control, because they set out the terms of reference by which you can look at a particular issue. And in this in that particular case, they were such limited terms that we couldn't even get the data that we needed to start to look at the problem. And one that Americans, in fact, the world can relate to, was the Warren Commission inquiry into the Kennedy assassination. And it's such an interview that it stuck in my mind because somebody said to him, why didn't you look at the Dallas connection and mafia and so on? And he said, well, it wasn't in my terms of reference. Well, it flew over most people's heads, but I knew exactly what he was saying. In other words, he was saying, look, I could only look at certain things. That's how they control them.
They frame the agenda.
Yeah, and so this is what Strong did with the IPCC. See, most people don't know that they defined climate change as only those changes caused by human activity. In other words, don't bother looking at natural causes of climate change. Only look at the things that are caused by humans. Well, the problem with that is you can't possibly determine what effect humans are having if you haven't got any idea how it changes naturally. But that's what's going on. And by putting the definition in it. Oh, yeah, it's an incredible thing. And, of course, he set it up through the World Meteorological Organization, which is a UN agency that all countries belong to. And the delegates at that WMO are...
And we will be right back talking about the delicate situation at the UN with that fabulous carbon tax empire we all hope to live and breathe. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Welcome back to the Vinny Eastwood Show. With Will, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. Welcome back, you moist New Zealanders, you frozen Americans, and you rigidly stiff upper lipped, literally because it's coated with ice. Brits, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. And let's not forget our friendly neighbours of the north, Canada, where Tim Ball is from. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Vinny.
Now, this recent weather, we've had ridiculous extremes, and the climate cultists are saying, that it's the result of global warming. Now, I would presume that weather extremes do happen relatively frequently. Has there been any long-range analysis of the extent of weather systems? Have things been gradually hyping up? Are things getting more extreme? Or is it just natural variation?
No, in fact, the 20th century and into this first 21st century, there has not been an increase. For example, they were going on about hurricanes. In fact, hurricanes have decreased in number and intensity. They cooked the books with that, by the way, Vinny. They tried to argue that they were more and more severe. What they did was they were only counting hurricanes within the western half of the Atlantic, and they started to count them from the coast of Africa. So they simply expanded the area. It was just deception. But the storms are more severe than they were, say, back in the 80s right now. And the reason for that is that the 80s was a period of warming. Now we're into a period of cooling, and the storms are triggered along the boundary between the cold polar air and the warmer tropical air. And it's a zone called the polar front. You see this in both the southern and northern hemispheres. And, of course, it's along that polar front where the temperature contrast is the greatest. That's where the jet stream flows. And, of course, it's a measure of the difference in temperature across that front. And along that front is where the middle-latitude cyclones, these storm systems, such as the one that just went through New York and tried to dislodge Mayor Bloomberg there, but these storms and blizzards are ripple along that front, and of course their intensity is determined by the temperature difference between the cold air and the warm air. And because the Earth is cooling, the cold air is pushing further south. I mean, if you look at the snow in Arizona recently, the storms on the West Coast in California, and the snow in the California mountains and so on, and the same thing in Australia and other parts of the world with the cold air pushing up. And so that means that the temperature contrast between the cold and the warm is greater, and then also happens to be in latitudes where an awful lot of people are living. And so it appears that, it's more storminess and so on, but it really isn't. It's a trend of the pattern of cooling that's going on. And you can look back in history, and I've done a great deal on this. You look at the severe weather, one of the classic ones, the last time we had a cooling trend like this, of this magnitude, was running into the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. And you read about the storm that destroyed the Spanish Armada. I mean, there was nothing like that in the 19th and 20th century until the latter part of the 20th century when the cooling began. So it's what's going on now is simply part of the natural trend of cool air advancing towards the equator and creating this contrast and triggering these storm systems. And, of course, the other thing that's happening, Vinny, is that everybody's had that experience of being introduced to somebody, and then it seems like every time you turn around, there they are. They were always there. They were just not part of your perception and awareness. Well, the same is true of what gets reported on the media. Now, every single little storm or strong wind or natural event is suddenly, in fact, if you watch even Fox News or any of them, they don't do the weather forecast now or weather reports. It's extreme weather. And so everything's hyped up.
Extreme weather!
So what do you think of climate change movement calling anyone who disputes their perception as reality, so-called facts, as a shill for the large petrochemical corporations?
Well, of course, that was the charge that was thrown against me, that it was said that I was paid by the oil companies. I've never received a nickel from any energy company, let alone oil companies. I wish I had, then I could afford their product. But, of course, this is the kind of discrediting that you're selling your integrity in order to get the money. What they forget in all of that is that there were many, many scientists that sold their integrity to get the funding from the World Meteorological Organization and through the various national agencies. For example, in the U.S., and they're spending $70 billion a year on climate research, and virtually all of that is coming from the government and the weather agencies. In Canada, for example, they spent $6.8 billion in 5 years at Environment Canada on climate change, and they had to take that money out of somewhere, and one place they took it was out of closing down weather stations. I already talked about that a bit. But they also don't do their own forecasting along the border now. They buy it from the U.S. because they haven't got the funding because they spent it on all these other things. So what needs to happen is a massive investigation of these national weather agencies. And there's one going on in the U.K. right now. They're looking at what's happening there because a fellow I've worked with for some time, Piers Corbyn, has been making very accurate forecasts for at least 12 years that I know of. And of course, I'll tell you how accurate he is. He was trying to establish his credibility and making bets with one of the betting companies in England. They won't take his bets anymore, which gives you a measure of how accurate he is. But the UK Weather Office or Met Office, they were deeply involved in this IPCC scandal and the Maurice Strong thing. They were up to their necks in it, and of course they were connected with the climatic research unit at East Anglia, where these emails were leaked that disclosed what they were doing. But the scandal.
They claim Exxon's on our side of the debate. It's not really true, is it? I mean, initially Exxon handed a few thousand dollars to so-called climate deniers, but then on the other side of the debate, we see millions of dollars being thrown around,
yep.
Government grants of research, and so on. What do you think Exxon? You know, what is their stated position now?
One of the things that the oil companies have been doing is that they've been funding the so-called environmental groups. We've got one here in Canada, David Suzuki Foundation, and he of course is yelling at the oil companies and yelling at the carbon and all the rest of it, but he gets funded by two oil companies. So that the hypocrisy knows no limit, but it's partly that the oil companies are simply trying to buy PR and trying to buy silence and to reduce the attacks. It's why they're into all of this carbon footprint thing, that they see it as a good public relations exercise to say, oh, well, we care about this. It's rubbish. It's hypocrisy as well. As you said, the amount of money going from governments in, and by the way, one of the problems with it is that all of the money from government was directed to proving what the IPCC were trying to establish, that is, CO2 was causing climate change. That's not the way science works. Science tries to disprove a theory, not prove it.
Yeah, no, exactly. But why is it that when you sat down with friends who believe in this climate change scam and they espouse the central idea that if you're not on their side of the debate, i.e. for the destruction of Western civilization, as we know it, because it's bad and evil and pollutes, even though they don't know about so many environmental pollution factors that I tend to harp on about, they automatically claim that you're with the big corporations, and the big corporations are the only evil people on this planet because governments aren't in cahoots with them at all.
And they're all corporation-y.
I mean, why is it that these people are so immune to facts, and you can put out dozens of facts like the ones you've mentioned already on the show,
And
they have one or two things they hang on to, and that seems to overpower, well, I'm still going to believe in climate change without doing the research.
Well, exactly, and I think Farhood Manju, who writes for Spike, he wrote an article or a book called Living in a Post-Fact Society, that you have an idea, and then you simply go out and pay the scientists to give you the facts you need to support your idea. And unfortunately, that's frighteningly true. But one of the reasons that so much deception has been allowed to go on is because, A, people are fearful, And Michael Crichton, in his book State of Fear, explained how the green groups exploit that, a wonderful book. But they also are exploiting people's lack of knowledge and lack of understanding. And, of course, when I stood up, and they say, oh, well, that person's not qualified. Or when I stood up, they couldn't say that. But, of course, the bias of that, too, is that every time I go on a program, I'm asked, what's your qualifications? Nobody ever asked Al Gore that. And yet, somehow he's an authority on these things. It's incredible. But the idea, by the way, about you're saying that if you don't agree with me, then you must be paid by the oil companies. That is a sad underlying theme of today's world and that whole left wing socialist view. If you're not with me, you must be against me. And it creates this frightening adversarial thing that they want. And, of course, then they come forward with, well, if you're not with me, you must be with those other evil people that are polluting the world and killing the babies and all the rest of the things. And so it then they twist it around. And, of course, one of the things that the environmental groups have done is steal the moral high ground, that only they care about the environment. And it's the most outrageous hijacking that I can imagine. The truth is we all care about the environment to a greater or lesser degree, but somehow these people say we don't and that only they care. But that's part of this.
Exactly, that's yeah. What I really find interesting about this whole debacle is that real environmentalism has literally been hijacked, where once there were people protesting about forests and clean water and, clean food and GMOs and all of this, they're now all climate cultists, It's almost as if activism in the environmental movement has stopped, but for this Church of Climatology.
Well, exactly. And by the way, one of the stories that puts that in perspective is a guy by the name of Patrick Moore, who was a co-founder of Greenpeace. And I know Patrick very well. I've been on several platforms with him. And he said within 5 years, he realized that the Marxists had moved in and hijacked the whole idea of Greenpeace. And he quit. And, of course, after that, he got viciously attacked with things like dumping huge piles of manure on his lawn and all sorts of things. But because he just came out and said, no, that it's been taken over for political agenda. But that's the whole point that we're talking about with the Club of Rome, was that they saw environmentalism and climate change as the vehicle to get control and to get one world government. Because basically what they're saying is, these evil capitalists have polluted the world, and we all have to band together and get rid of them, and we can only do that if we have one world government. We're all fighting this together. So the environmental movement became their vehicle. And of course, the other thing about it, Vinny, is that... Yeah. Well, the other thing, Vinny, is that... And you notice there's so much we should talk about, but you notice the books like Richard Dawkins about God is Dead and all of these things. That's part of this same argument. That's part of the same debate that's going on, because Darwin, who was an atheist, when he got rid of God, which was the purpose for humans being here and different from all the other animals, then he effectively got rid of religion. And, of course, that left the young people completely blank. So here comes environmentalism as the new religion, and the Gaia thing that was created by Lovelock and all of that. So it becomes almost cultist in its operation.
It's funny you say that, Tim, because didn't I just say that just yesterday, Vinny, to you? I mean, wasn't this the whole problem? Like, I said that the Founding Fathers had this model for America that, there was a creator on top, and then the creator empowered people with rights, and then people empowered government, yep, and so on and so forth. Yep. And now the creator's been replaced by government and their crony mates. And yep. The left, I mean, they'll just attack us straight away. They'll say Will Ryan's a complete nut. He believes in God. He believes in one world order, because they don't want to look at the facts on the ground. They tend to think that the only corrupt people on this planet are in corporations, never in government.
And the definition of delusion is being shown contrary evidence and refusing to look at it. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, where we're not climate cultists for a change. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. for some kind of way out of here. Said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. You can also check out our website with our fabulous archives at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Our very special guest is Dr. Tim Ball. What's your website? Is it FCPP.org?
Well, I don't have a website specifically. I'm involved with two groups. One is the Canada Free Press, where I publish articles twice a week. But the other one that I helped set up was a group called Friends of Science, .org. And then the other one that's associated, and now we're expanding on, it's with the book, and that is slayingtheskydragon.com. And they can get information about some of the things we're talking about here today, because the book is laying out the motive and how they've achieved being able to fool the whole world into the climate scam.
The whole climate scam. Now, we have an end game, and as far as I see it, if you want to have any type of lifestyle or whatever, you have to emit CO2. So in order to tax it, you'd be taxing on very human activity in its purest form. So therefore, human activity would more or less have to cease. So that means there would have to be an enormous population reduction, which would be done if, as long as taxes were high enough and police were funded enough. But on the other hand here, we have a, well, shall we say, spanners in the works like yourself who are raising the issue that this is an entire fraud designed to basically destroy humanity and steal all its wealth. What kind of a opposition have you encountered to your advancements here?
Well, it's been very nasty. Apart from the fact that I was the longest in rank as an assistant professor in the history of Canadian universities, and some of the nastiest attacks, of course, coming from inside the university, but concerted attacks through a, well, I don't even give them credit for their blog site, but the Suzuki Foundation that I mentioned, they have been spreading all kinds of false information. One of it was through Wikipedia, and of course, a lot of people don't know, but the climate group at East Anglia, through a fellow by the name of William Connolly, who actually ran as a Marxist in an election in Britain, he was editor of 500 sites on Wikipedia, all related to climate, and he put on there, of course, their message. If you went in and changed it within 20 minutes, it was right back to the way it was. They recently fired him as the editor of that of those 500 sites. So what was happening was, of course, that anybody that went to get information on climate got what the people at the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia, who we now know were corrupt, what the message they were pushing. This is the degree to which they have controlled and manipulated the whole process. And but the attacks, the first ones were I was called a climate skeptic. And then when I pointed out that, no, all scientists are skeptics. If you're not a skeptic, you're not a scientist. So, throw another one at me. And then the next one came up, be a name dropper here, but the Times of London, I was labeled a climate change denier. And, of course, with all of the Holocaust connotations of that word. And then I pointed out that, no, look, my whole career has been trying to explain to people how much climate change is. I'm anything but a denier. And so that sort of fizzled out a little bit. And now, because of the exposures, and I've had death threats, I didn't want to talk about those because I knew a lot of scientists that didn't agree with what was going on but didn't want to get involved in the politics of it or the nastiness of it. And so I did a documentary with Martin Durkin of Channel 4 in England called The Great Global Warming Swindle. And he asked me about it, and that's where I raised the issue. And, of course, interestingly, since that went public, I haven't received any more. But you still get the attacks and the challenges and the fact that they pay by the oil companies and the rest of it. But you just got to keep plowing ahead. As you guys find out, if you stand up in the coconut shy, they're going to throw at you.
Well, we're no strangers to being battered around or hassled by security or anything like this. You know, we're real truthers. We get right in the thick of it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you see, this was another part of the game that was played was the consensus argument. You heard that one, that, oh, well, the majority of scientists. The trouble with that argument is that a consensus is not a scientific fact. And as Einstein said, you can have 100 things right, you got one thing wrong, and you're wrong. That's the end of it. But they tried this consensus argument, and of course what they were actually talking about were the people that were involved with the IPCC. And these were all government appointees or scientists who had a political agenda to push, like James Hansen, the head of NASA GIS, and he's been manipulating the weather records for years now, and Hansen, by the way, is very interesting. Here, these are government employees that are actually very deeply involved in the politics of this issue, which really goes right against the Hatch Act and other rules for bureaucrats. But the bureaucracy is
coming up to break here. Tim, I was wondering if you'd be so kind as to join us after the break.
Well, I would. If you are happy to have me, I'm happy to stay on.
Absolutely. It would be our honor, sir. Our very special guest is Dr. Tim Ball, ladies and gentlemen, the fabulous climate researcher and a very, very qualified man to be talking about this subject with. So I'm very, very glad to have the opportunity to have him on over the break. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Fastest 2 hours in talk radio, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Welcome back also to Dr. Tim Ball from SlayingTheSkyDragon.com.
Well, thank you, Vinnie. We will continue to try and help people understand what's happened, what the motive was, and what possibly we could do about it.
Well, that's the thing. The people who do understand will be the people who actually want to. However, there's another set of people, the people who believe in it so blindly that they'll fight against anybody who questions it, researches it, denies it, etc., whatever label they want to put on somebody. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who feel absolutely hopeless in the face of this this religion that is kind of defecating on science itself.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the things that you start to realize is, and I fought with extremism and all of these things all of my career, but there's about... 35 to 40% on one side of an issue, and about 20% of them are not going to change their minds no matter what you say. The same at the other end of the spectrum. There's the 40% that have the opposite view, and 20% of them are not going to change their mind no matter what. The critical thing, of course, is the group in the middle, and you can see that in U.S. politics. It's that the independent in the middle, and if you get enough of them, then you get the majority that can swing over and provide the majority that the founding fathers understood was the critical thing. And it was nice to see, by the way, how they realized that if you were going to have demagogues taking over, you had to have a system to catch them fairly quickly. And of course, the November elections did that job very well. Now, the question is, of course, whether the new newly elected people will follow through on what they've committed to do, and what's needed is for the public who understand these issues to give them the support and the backbone to do that. But of course, it is one of the, again, the reason that they've been able to deceive people with environmental issues and in the climate in particular is because it's science. And one of the things that I taught science credits for art students at the university, so I know the division, and there's about 80% of the population that are proud that they can't even add up numbers, and another 20% that just thrive on numbers. And so you're fighting a battle there with basically the art society. And where you see this, by the way, is in law schools, where most lawyers are art students, and most of them fail the tax course in second year. And of course, now we've got increasing environmental legislation that requires an understanding of science. So the problems aren't going to go away. And of course, the purpose of our book, Slaying the Sky Dragon, is to try and
understand what is going on. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We'll be right back with our special guest.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
We can't see
the way it's going to be. Thunder clouds rolling in, it's gonna rain. And I take some cover, wind is wild. Rain keeps falling down, it's gonna fall.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. Our very special guest is Dr. Tim Ball. One of the most prestigious figures in the so-called climate denier movement, would be fair to say, wouldn't it, Doctor?
Well, yeah, that's sort of like saying expert. I'm always afraid when I hear somebody's an expert. But thank you.
Yes.
I've certainly taken a lot of the heavy blows in standing up.
Trust the experts.
Yes. Certain words that, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, yeah. certain things that can scare you.
The scariest ones that you'll ever freaking hear.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of which, how is the government working around climate change? Because in New Zealand, our government basically is passing legislation in a day through Parliament, and all of a sudden we've got carbon taxes. What's happening in the rest of the world in terms of this legislation? How are they implementing this scam?
Well, of course, the public still are not don't know enough to challenge. They sense there's something wrong, and it's sort of like the old Popeye thing. I don't know how she just does it, but she just does it. And the politicians, of course, are aware of that. The hypocrisy is in the politicians. A lot of them know that this is scientific nonsense, but of course they see an opportunity to grab some extra taxes, and that's what it's all about at the local political level. And but the way that they're implementing these things isn't necessarily through the cap and trade. As you know, the carbon market has virtually collapsed. And in fact, I noticed just 2 days ago, another 100 people in Europe charged with cooking the books on carbon credits. And you know, the mafia got into it very quickly. But what they're doing is they're bypassing the political process, the Senate, the Congress. I mean, Obama would have liked the cap and trade bill passed because in his first budget, he budgeted over $500 billion of revenue from it over the next 10 years. But he knows it's not going to go through. So what they're doing, and he's doing this with the health care legislation, but particularly the environmental, and that's the one I'm most familiar with, is that they're putting in place rules and regulations that only the bureaucrats have the authority to do. So, for example, there were a couple of years ago when Obama got into power initially, the state of Massachusetts brought a suit against the Environmental Protection Agency saying that they were not doing their job of controlling CO2 as a toxic pollutant. And the EPA, of course, had to defend against it. And from everything I've heard from lawyers and so on, their defense was basically to make sure they lost the case. Because when they lost the case, that meant then that CO2 became listed as a toxic substance, which is the most outrageous thing you can imagine. It's like saying oxygen's a toxic substance because it causes rust. And
I actually made that point to a lawyer, and he said, "Well, you know, water can kill you if you have too much of it." That was the rationalization for it.
Well, exactly. And of course, as Paracelsus said back in the 16th century, the toxicity is in the dosage. So that's nothing new to science. But you see, the minute that you got CO2 listed as a toxic substance, and the Supreme Court, by the way, looked at the Massachusetts EPA case and ruled 5-4 in favor of the verdict. Justice Scalia said, "This is scientific rubbish. I can't believe that we're doing this." But the minute it became a toxic substance, then the EPA had complete authority to control it. And the listeners should pay heed, because this coming week, the EPA, under the direction of Lisa Jackson, and you can go read about her politics, has the authority now to just go in on their say-so and decide that a factory is producing too much CO2 and shut it down. Now, this will be, of course, part of Obama's pledge. But before he got elected, they said, "Well, what about coal plants?" And he said, "Well, you can build a coal plant, but I'll make it so that you won't be able to make a profit. I'll shut you down." And they said, "Well, what is that going to cost?" He said, "It means that the price of energy is going to skyrocket." Well, that's what you're going to see start this week. That and of course, just like with the carbon credits, who decides how much a carbon credit's worth? Who decides which plant is producing too much or too little? And then, of course, all of it based on the idea that CO2 is a problem when it isn't. So it's just the most. It's almost Alice in Wonderland kind of things that are going on.
So let me get this straight. If it's a madness premise, settled on the massive blanket of ignorance that we currently have, thanks to mainstream media in no small part, and all our ridiculously lying and corrupt politicians who never keep their word and do everything they can to enslave us, tax us, and make us live life a little more harshly. If that's the case, where are they heading with all of this? I mean, what's life going to be like if everybody has their way? You know, a typical day's life today will be very vastly different in these futuristic type societies. And indeed, in Hamilton, people are actually passing out Agenda 21 leaflets printed by Greenpeace.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the things that's interesting about all of this, and just before I respond to that side of it, if you get into an argument with somebody, it's been thrown at me many times, but I'm able to deal with it, they'll say, well, shouldn't we act anyway, just in case? All right, that's called the precautionary principle, and it's something that Greenpeace and other environmental groups developed back in the 80s and said, well, you know, shouldn't we act anyway just in case? Well, the problem is I, as a scientist, can create all kinds of scary potential scenarios, and we have to priorize them, but you can't priorize them if you're shaking so much and don't understand the science, and that's how they work it. But with regard to your question about where is this all leading, what's frightening about what Obama's getting away with particularly is that Europe are ahead. Europe have been doing these things. They've been bringing in the green jobs. They've been switching to wind power and alternate energies and letting nuclear power stations die off simply because of age, shutting down coal-burning plants and so on. And the worst example, of course, is Spain. And Spain is on the verge of economic collapse. They've just decided to shut down all of their wind power turbines. They're paying a horrendous price, and yet they only dabbled in it briefly. And by the way,
Speaking of paying a horrendous price, this one from the Daily Mail, fresh humiliation for Eurozone as China says it will bail out debt-ridden nations. They've got this $2.7 trillion overseas investment fund to barrel out the EU.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, you then become puppets to China, which is you can use all the fantasy terms you like about state capitalism, but the truth is it's communist. Any other sort of facade that they present that, oh, yeah, well, we're actually capitalist because we're involved in the market, it is an absolute illusion. And of course, you've got to know when people like Vladimir Putin are saying, don't go down that path, to the Americans, you better listen. And of course, Václav Klaus, the president of the Czech Republic, he spoke as a keynote speaker at the first so-called skeptics conference in New York a couple of years ago, and his opening comment was, "We've gone through 70 years of communism. Why the hell would you ever want to go back to that?" And so you can see in what's going on in Europe a foretaste of where America's heading, and of course that's what they want. Obama is actually, I think, trying to deliberately collapse the American economy.
Well, a lot of people don't see any problem with communism because they think it's the answer to the current strife we're in, because they identify the current, wrongly identify the current strife we're in as a capitalist problem. In simple terms, without understanding anything, they just say, well, greed means capitalism, because they watch Wall Street or something. They think that's all the understanding they need. And then the reason why we have these seemingly disparate random facts, such as CO2 being labeled a toxin, people aren't putting it together as an agenda because they don't realize that that was just a move so that in a legislation, the EPA can now regulate CO2.
Yep.
People can't put together an agenda. I find this is a fatal flaw of our society, of our beer-swilling, temperate, vapid society, is we can't actually take a fact and link it to another and link it to another, as our brains have been programmed, as gave us a, you know, even if people believe in evolution, an evolutionary advantage over our fellow animals.
Well, of course, and this is absolutely right, and it's no small coincidence that a lot of the so-called research that's been done has been done within the universities. I mean, the climatic research unit at the University of East Anglia, and one of the things, I mean, apart from the corruption generally intellectually within universities, education is no longer education, it's indoctrination, and we saw the environmental movement take over the universities. I watched it, that you got environmental studies programs where you didn't have to have any science or understanding. You were an environmentalist. They're all now in government and out in the world. And so those of course are the carriers of the faith, but within the universities is where so much of this has gone on, and that was also related to funding. I watched over my career where when I started out it was publish or perish, and that was fair enough. You needed to publish and remain current in your particular area of specialization, but it gradually shifted, so it became more important on how much funding you were bringing in to your promotion and advancement within the university, because universities discovered that they could skim up to 35% or 40% off the top of any research grant that a faculty member got. And so the faculty member then became important, not for their intellectual contributions, but for their monetary contributions. And now there was supposedly a reasonable argument made for it, and they said, well, we're providing you with an office and heat and light, and therefore this is just a portion of that. But what people did was simply increase the demand for the amount of money and inflated it to cover that. And, of course, that was always available because it was coming from government. And and people very quickly learned how to play this game. I mean, I sat on committees looking at research applications, and they realized which were the key words, the buttons to push to get the money from the government. I joked about, this is over 20 years ago, I was joking about how if I could find a connection between climate and AIDS, the money would come pouring in. And So you see the kinds of intellectual corruptions that have gone on, and I happen to think, by the way, a lot of this is involved in that whole liberal idea that that you can't fail, that you've got to have positive results all the time. And of course, one of the things with the climate or the IPCC was that they thwarted science. Now, normally, science, you'd have a hypothesis or a theory, and then there'd be assumptions. Another scientist then skeptically try to disprove it. The theory that human CO2 was causing climate change became a fact almost instantly, and they set about attacking anybody that dared to question it with all of the things we discussed earlier in the program. So a lot of the rot has gone on within academia, and as I said, driven a lot by the funding and also the fact that, you can't fail. You've got to have positive results, and you'll do whatever's necessary to get those. And I watched this with students.
That's another great point. In New Zealand driver's license test now, and for school C, 15 and through to their final year at school, around 17, 18, they now have a new NCEA system where you get unsatisfactory, I believe, rather than back when I was at school, 10 years ago, it was just a fail.
Yep.
A pure, an out-and-out fail. So now we've got this liberal idea that there's no black and white, there's no facts, there's no right and wrong. It's about merging everything into this liberal, loving, accept everyone. Everyone's just an opinion of equal worth. Tim hasn't got any facts, it's just his perception.
Yeah, well, of course, part of the problem is in the use of the word failure or failing. I mean, I had a student that was just beside himself because he failed one of my climatology courses. And I said, look, just because you failed a climate course doesn't mean to say you're a failure. All I'm telling you is you ain't going to be a climatologist. You might go and be the best sheet metal worker that ever lived, but the system isn't set up to allow you to find that out. And so this idea of failing has become completely perverted, and instead of allowing the individual, and here we come back to that theme, to find out what they're best at and what they how they can contribute best to the society, you've got to fit into the box, you've got to conform, and if you don't, you're a failure. And of course, part of that is in all of the Western countries, every kid that's going into kindergarten is assumed that they're going to end up in university, which by default means that if they don't get there, they're a failure. And so we've created this horrendous system of indoctrination in the schools. And by the way, I used to warn my students, you know, I said, if you go for an interview and they say, we want somebody that thinks outside the box, don't work there, because you'll find out the minute you think outside the box, they'll fire you. And of course, I saw that in university. I've seen it in science. And in fact, that's one of the themes of our book, Slaying the Sky Dragon, is that it's the people that can step outside of the you know, indoctrinated thinking and look at things differently that are going to find better answers.
And that's the reason why those people are kind of left in general out of the public debate. I mean, academia has been totally co-opted by this idea with very, very little resistance, it seems, from the student bodies. They don't care. They think it's just great.
No, well, of course, one of the things, again, a shift that I personally witnessed, and obviously I it's empirical, I don't have academic research to prove it, but in the old days, and I'm talking now 30, 40 years ago, you had the older professors with the prevailing wisdom, if you want, and then the new young bloods came in and challenged that. Now it's completely the reverse. If you look at the people like myself or Richard Lindzen, we're all the old guard. We're the old professors.
Oh my goodness, and it seems that the old guard, the old professors, and the old ways are all being chucked out as if they were unrecyclable plastic. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Yes, I have.
I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota,
Buffalo, welcome Toronto, back Winslow, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Now, very well, fantastic, great guest is Dr. Tim Ball from SlayingTheSkyDragon.com. Tim, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Vinnie. Where do we want to pick up again? We were talking about you know, the change in university from the new young people coming in that are doctrinaire, dogmatic, and the old guard are challenging the prevailing wisdom, which is a complete turnaround in the 40 years of my career. And, of course, I think... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, wanted to talk about on the subject was that this is developing a lot of animosity and indeed hate within general political thought practice in almost every sector of society, that there is this hate aspect. Those who know the truth about what climate change really is and how it happens all the time and that kind of thing versus the average climate cultist who we're kind of derogatory to on this show, I must admit, freely. There's this kind of a schism between these two groups that gets them fighting with each other. And I'm very concerned about this because I don't actually hate the climate cultists. I just think that they don't know what's going on and they never listen.
Yeah.
And it gets me really, really angry. So what's going on here? I mean, like, are we all just doomed to, like, fight each other over this? And to, I mean, would there be a tipping point with their mass deception that where it'll crumble apart?
I think that it's an extension of what we talked about earlier, that this idea that if you're not with me, you must be against me, which becomes very divisive. And of course, it's being developed between, as you said, the environmental cultists and people that are have other views. And I heard somebody once at a meeting say, "Look, we can disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable." And that of course, the idea of discourse, again, the founding fathers and the town hall meetings. But look what's happened to them, where extremists are allowed to get up and shout and yell and bully and intimidate people. And society has to somehow temper that and control that and say, okay, you're entitled to your view, but you're not going to force us into that by your tactics. And George Will wrote a lovely essay about this a few years ago on the loss of civility in society. And of course, it's also part of the education system where, you know, that you're not allowed to control the child in the classroom. You're not allowed to have discipline in the classroom, which allows then everybody to participate, that you've got to cater to that one disruptive student all the time. And it just doesn't work. And so you've got this idea that somehow it's a perverse liberal idea that everybody can be an individual, but it doesn't work. You end up with anarchy. Everybody's entitled to be an individual in terms of developing themselves, but it's got to be done in the context of society as a whole. And this is where it's breaking down. So hopefully at some point, society will pay a price. We'll go through some disruptions, but hopefully we can put it back on track. And another part of it, and I've seen it in the Aboriginal communities up here in Canada, because I chaired hearings all through the North and the Arctic. Nobody, at all of those public hearings, nobody ever spoke till all of the elders had spoken. And the elders, it was amazing because they could all get up and speak extemporaneously for 15, 20 minutes on a subject, and each had a different view. And then at the end, a collective decision was made. And, of course, that kind of... And then I chaired meetings in the South where people were threatening to shoot each other, and it got, really nasty. But it's all part of this degrading of experience, devaluing experience. Oh, well, you can't handle a computer, therefore you don't know anything. And the technocracy that is so frightening. I think that's where the problem is. I taught seniors classes, so these were non-credit courses for people over 65, and they all were raised to believe that when they got old, their experience would be valued, and suddenly they get old, and nobody wants to know them. And I think it's a fatal mistake.
Well, this is an interesting side of the technology aspect. I mean, I would wonder what would happen to a society where all previous knowledge kind of from the elder generation basically gets lost because the elder generation can't contribute into the modern communication sphere.
Yeah. Well, of course, one of the bizarre things that might happen is because they've run up the bill for retirement and pensions and so on, it'll get so heavy that they're extending the retirement age. So maybe they'll be forced into keeping some of these more experienced people around. But yes, the loss of you have a cultural amnesia, and people forget that the current knowledge is simply a continuum of all previous knowledge. And I've watched this go on. In fact, I was just on an email debate with a group of people because some guy published an article, a Judah Cohen, I think his name was, in the New York Times, saying, oh, well, he understood why the cold, and it was the snow in Siberia and all of this stuff and the cold air coming down from the north. Well, that was in the literature 40 years ago. But he obviously knew nothing about the classic literature and what was there. And as I always used to point out to the students, one of the great values of history is that you think you're so smart and you find out some Greek said it 2,000 years ago. There's a humanizing aspect to that. And of course, they don't want the history taught anymore. They want to control the history that's taught. And these are all signs of people that are trying to control every individual. And we see it happening within society.
I know, and the worst part about it is when you start to have an argument with somebody and you know what they're going to say.
Yep. It's very, very predictable. Yeah, incidentally, one side of this... Yeah, sorry, Vinny. One side of this thing that I wanted to talk about with the climate, and it is part of the whole general discussion. Climate, let me explain, define the difference between weather and climate. Weather is what you experience when you're standing outside. And it's the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation from deep space to heat coming off the volcanoes on the bottom of the ocean and everything in between. And it's what scientists call white noise. But white noises are made up of individual red noises. So when you're in the weather, it's like standing outside of a stadium with 120,000 people all roaring while you're hearing that the sum total of every individual voice, which is a red noise, as the white noise from the stadium. And what they're trying to tell you is that they can identify the one voice in there, CO2, that's causing all of that noise and controlling that noise. That's how ridiculous what's going on is. But one of the things that's happened, and it started, ironically, in the year that Darwin published his Origin of the Species in 1857, a guy died by the name of Alexander von Humboldt. And he was generally regarded as the last universal person. That is, that he knew all of the biology, chemistry, physics that there was known at that time. He'd also been to every continent except Antarctica. And But from his time on, the volume of knowledge has increased so much that no one person can really encompass it all. And so what has happened is that, we talk about Renaissance people that have a sort of a fairly widely read and generally understanding things. But what's happened in academia is you've gone from general degrees, liberal arts degrees, and general science degrees into specialization, increasing specialization. And, of course, people don't understand this. I'd say to a student, well, what are you going to do? Well, I want to specialize. Oh, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to be a doctor. So, no, that's not a specialization. Red blood cells, that's a specialization. And so in academia, you've broken down into increasingly small pieces of information, and it's almost, and the analogy I use with the environmental issue or climate issue is that everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, but we've lost the box top. And of course, weather then is made up of this incredibly complex number of pieces in the puzzle, but climate is the average of weather. So it's how the weather changes over time, or the pattern of weather in a particular area, and that's the relationship between them. But climate then is a generalist discipline. You've got to know about changes in the sun, and this gives you an example of what I'm talking about. You pick up most textbooks still today, they tell you the orbit of the Earth around the sun is a fixed elliptical orbit. That's simply not true, and we've known for 150 years that's not true, but we're still teaching it. It changes it from almost circular as it is now to extreme ellipse as it was 20,000 years ago, and it's caused primarily by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter. But why are we still teaching in scientific information? It's 150 years out of date, but that's what's going on. But what you've got then is these individual specialists, each with a piece of the puzzle. So some guy pops up and says, "Oh, methane! Yeah, it's destroying the planet. It's the issue. Blah blah blah." Say, no. That's just one small piece of the puzzle. And so we haven't got the people to put the puzzle back together again. And let me give you a good example of what I'm talking about. You think about medicine. where the general practitioner now, all they do is simply list your symptoms and try and narrow it down a bit and then decide which specialist they're going to send you to see. And my favorite story, not true at all, but it summarizes it, where you've got a patient lying on the table, and the podiatrist is looking at the feet, and the nephrologist is looking at the kidneys, and the neurologist is looking at the brain, and the nurse is in the corner saying, "But doctors, the patient's dead." And so, this is what's been happening in science, and particularly in climate science, and one of the things that the IPCC did was that they literally rewrote history. We know that there was a very warm period about 1,000 years ago when the Vikings were farming in Greenland in soil that's now permanently frozen, when they were sailing in Arctic waters that are now permanent pack ice and so on, and it was even warm enough that you could live in Scotland. That's how warm it got. But it Can I slide
yeah,
that one?
Things have changed since then.
Yeah, keep going. But you see, they were saying, "Oh no, today it's warmer than it's ever been," and people like me were getting up and saying, no, sorry, 1,000 years ago, it was warmer." Well, they literally doctored the record to eliminate that medieval warm period, as it's called. And that became the infamous hockey stick. They were actually rewriting history. And so the level of corruption, and they could get away with it because how many people were going to know what they were doing? Because everybody's a specialist. And one of the things that we've done in the book, Slaying the Sky Dragon, is that we've got... I introduced the book with all of these ideas and the specialist idea, and then there are specialists who are showing how each specialist's piece of knowledge was misused by them, misapplied. And
that's a general theme, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah.
They want us to just be to be narrowed, focused, educated idiots who just keep out of their business when it comes to any other dictate influence in our lives and to say, trust the experts, you're not an expert on that subject matter.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, of course, that's why when you look at the people that are successful in business, like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, these are university dropouts. They see it for the rubbish that it is. And by the way, the most common degree, a PhD, amongst business CEOs is in history or philosophy, because those are, you know, broader looks at the whole picture of things, which is what you need as a CEO. But it shows how inappropriate education has become.
That's
people
right.
People do their own education.
And those are the first people to be targeted by Hitler, as I've said many times in the show, as homeschoolers, because unless you get the state or whoever the ruling system is to educate your children, they won't have a supportive base for their continuation of their reign, will they? So the idea is to really brainwash an entire generation so that they believe so heartedly in this thing that anybody else who sits up above them.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, "I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning." But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business. It's business time.
Climate change business time.
Yeah. That's right. We go brush our teeth.
Certainly a lot
That's
of people making
of
a crop of cash off of this massive, inaffectionate climate change movement. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen, and also welcome back to our very special guest, Dr. Tim Ball, coming at us from the fabulous Canada. How's the weather out there? Is it global warming enough?
No, we're waiting for it to come, and I always tell people it's another undelivered government promise.
Hey, Tim, can you break down it with the brilliant facts you have in your mind and need to be need to be promoted around the planet? Can you break down just how much of the atmosphere is made up by CO2 once again, and then how much of that humans contribute, and then how much of the total amount of CO2 might be a factor in the 0.7 degrees Celsius warming we saw over the last century? Can you break down just how minute they end up getting?
Sure. I've got to pull up the graph that I have that gives me those details, and I'll have it here shortly. But the greenhouse gases, there are three major greenhouse gases are water vapor, which is 95% by volume of the greenhouse gases, and most people have no idea of that. And then the second one is CO2, carbon dioxide, which is about 3.8% of the total greenhouse gases. Now, this is not in the atmosphere. And then methane, which is 0.36%. And, of course, a few years ago, they were blaming the cattlemen and saying, the methane from your cows is causing climate change and warming and so on. And then they got sidewinded by a fact that atmospheric levels of methane have gone down for the last 15 years. But those are the proportions. Now, when you asked about the percentage of those that is man-made, these are very gross estimates. It's estimated that of carbon dioxide, of the 3.6% that is in the atmosphere, 0.117% is man-made. As I said, these are crude estimates. And the reason I say that is because we don't know. The amount that humans produce is so small, I do know that if everybody left the planet and they left one scientist behind to measure the difference in CO2 levels because humans are gone, they would not be able to detect the difference.
What do you say to the climate changers who then argue and they say, I'm not saying that man is causing climate change entirely, but we are tipping the balance. We are overdoing the balance that existed prior to our enormous evil population. What do you say to those people? And then to tie that into what you said earlier about the focus of climate change being only on man-made, human-induced factors.
And of course you hear that phrase tipping point all the time. And we've reached a tipping point, but it's going to cooling, so it's not going the way they wanted it to. To answer some of those questions, first of all, we don't know, except by crude estimates, how much CO2 is put into the atmosphere naturally. For example, the oceans contribute somewhere between 90 and 100 gigatons a year. Now, notice that's a 10 gigaton error factor. Humans, according to the IPCC, and they're producing their own figures, and I have a great deal of concern with that because they're getting the data from individual countries, and we know that Turkey and Germany cook their data in order to get more carbon credits. So it's UN figures that are just rubbish. But they estimate that humans are producing 9.5 gigatons. Each year, adding to the atmosphere. So notice that 9.5 gigatons is within the error of the estimate of how much the oceans are putting up. It's also within the error of the amount of CO2 that's coming from the soils and other sources, rotting vegetation and so on, going into the atmosphere. So just on two natural sources, the amount we put up is within the error factor. But there's some other problems beyond that, because and I call it the black paint argument to help people understand it. The CO2 that's in the atmosphere now, and they're saying it's 385 parts per million, which is an infinitesimally small amount of the total gases in the atmosphere. They're saying that that is supposedly preventing heat from the Earth escaping to space or slowing it down, and therefore the temperature of the Earth is going up. And the problem is that even if CO2 in the atmosphere doubled or tripled, the temperature can only go up by a certain amount. And the way to understand it, the black paint idea, is if you want to stop light coming through a window, if you put on one coat of black paint, it blocks over 90% of the light. Okay? And so the 385 parts per million, and in fact it's a small portion of that, is already working as a greenhouse gas to hold the heat in. And so if you doubled it, it's like adding a second coat of black paint to your window. It doesn't reduce the amount of light coming through by very much. And it's basically what's called a saturation factor. Now, the IPCC...
Thanks, Tim. We have to cut you off there. Sorry, we've run out of time. Thank you, Tim Ball. You've been great. Vinny, do you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, absolutely. His website, ladies and gentlemen, is flyingtheskydragon.com, and you'll be able to find the archive of this show available at the vinnyeastwoodshow.com in the archive section. I'd like to very much offer our appreciation for Tim Ball to be giving us so much of his time on this lowly Vinny Eastwood show. With Will! But we'll be back later on tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, for our final show of the year.